Yeah, Times. Israel's far-right party leader Naftali Bennett says he will form a coalition with opposition leader Yair Lapid to unseat Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Danish and European media report that the US spied on top politicians in Europe, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel from 2012 to 2014. Also ahead, South Africa extends its nightly curfew and limits the number of people at gatherings to slow the spread of COVID-19. Welcome to World News from the reigning capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Israel's far-right party leader Naftali Bennett says he will form a coalition with opposition leader Yair Lapid to unseat incumbent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under a prospective power-sharing deal, Bennett will serve as Prime Minister for 2 years before being replaced by Lapid for the second half of the term. Lapid's centrist party, Yesh Atid, came second to Netanyahu's right-wing Likud in general elections in March. Lapid now faces a Wednesday deadline from Israel's president to announce the formation of a cabinet. Netanyahu says a Bennett-Lapid coalition would be a danger for the regime. Israel has held 4 inconclusive votes in the past 2 years. Now, a new report shows the United States, with the help of Danish intelligence, spied on top European politicians from 2012 to 2014. A team of European media revealed that the espionage campaign was led by US National Security Agency, which targeted politicians from Germany, Sweden, Norway and France. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was among those targeted. Denmark's defense minister, who was informed of the spying in August 2020, said systematic eavesdropping of close allies is unacceptable. The report shows that Washington continued to spy on its allies even after the 2013 Snowden affair. Back then, U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden revealed that the U.S. government was spying on its own citizens and its allies. 2 people have been killed and more than 20 injured in yet another mass shooting in the U.S. The shooting took place outside the billiards club in the city of Miami early Sunday morning. Police say a gang of 3 shot indiscriminately into a crowd and fled the scene. No one has been arrested so far. The U.S. has a long history of deadly gun violence, with schools, workplaces and shopping centers being frequently targeted. Last year, nearly 20,000 gun-related deaths were recorded there. That's more than any other year in at least 2 decades. President Joe Biden has described the gun violence in his country as an epidemic and an international embarrassment. Elsewhere, the remains of more than 200 indigenous children have been discovered at the site of a former residential school in Canada. Some of the children were as young as 3 years old. The discovery has opened old wounds for indigenous people across Canada and is yet another instance of the country's historical anti-indigenous campaign.
A mass grave containing the remains of 215 indigenous children has been discovered in Canada. The remains were unearthed at the site of a former residential school for indigenous children near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, including some as young as 3 years old. The authorities said an investigation into the timing and cause of their death is underway. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, reacted to the news by calling it distressing and a reminder of a dark chapter in Canada's history. Also, Canada's National Centre for Truth and Reconciliation said in a statement that the discovery of bodies of Indigenous children at a former residential school is a reminder of the violence that had been inflicted on Indigenous societies. The Kamloops Indian Residential School was the largest in Canada's residential school system. It was part of a network of schools run by the Roman Catholic Church from the 1870s until 1996. For more than a century, Canadian authorities forcibly assimilated Indigenous children by separating them from their families and forbidding them from speaking their native languages or performing cultural practices. Residential schools' main objective was assimilating the children into white Canadian society by severing their Indigenous family and cultural ties. These were the values that colonial settlers, who made up the majority of the population at that time, brought to Canada. Children were victims of widespread physical, emotional, and sexual abuses within these institutions. Today, those experiences are blamed for a high incidence of poverty, alcoholism, and domestic violence, as well as high suicide rates in their community.
The land that is stolen from them is simply a result. It's not the cause. It is certainly part and parcel of it. The Indigenous population has suffered greatly since the first white Europeans colonists came to Canada. They stole the land, but they oppressed the people. They killed them. They enslaved them. This is a long, long history of settler colonialism that Canada has not yet come completely to terms with, and it needs to.
At least 150,000 children attended residential schools in Canada. In 2015, a historic National Truth and Reconciliation Commission described it as a culture of genocide targeting the country's Indigenous people. However, while these schools no longer exist today, it is a stark reminder of how these children were treated for decades. Many had been taken away from their families for no other reason than the color of their skin.
Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against the children. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded that the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners. The documents revealed that many students lost their lives because they were exposed to outbreaks of measles, tuberculosis, influenza, and other contagious diseases. Over 4,100 children died due to diseases or in accidents at schools have been identified to date. They were often buried in unmarked graves without identification or notice to their parents. Moreover, while the residential schools may be closed, Indigenous children continue to be separated from their families in disproportionate numbers. According to census data, in 2016, more than 52% of children in foster care were Indigenous. That's while Indigenous children made up 7.7% of Canada's all foster children in care population. The systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada has existed for decades. Despite making up just 5% of Canada's population, 30% of the country's prisoners are Indigenous. Also, the government has willfully and recklessly discriminated against Indigenous children living on reserves by failing to provide funding for child and family services.
Yes, their rights will be respected, but it will be because of activists, people within the Native community who are working very hard now. There are many, many people who are working for the rights of Indigenous people, people not only members of that community, but members of other communities within Canada. They're working hard to implement government changes, to make the government see that it must respect their rights.
Forced removal, genocide, and assimilation are what colonial settlers inflicted on the Indigenous peoples in Canada. After all, what's for sure is that Canada's foundation as a country is based upon the process of colonization.
Turning elsewhere now, South Africa reimposes stricter measures against COVID-19 as the country braces for a third wave of the pandemic.
Further restrictions are necessary to ensure that health facilities are not overwhelmed and that lives that could be saved are not lost. Delaying the spread of the virus is especially important now to allow as many people as possible to be vaccinated before the third wave reaches its peak.
Ramaphosa says nightly curfews will be extended and the number of people at gatherings will be limited in an attempt to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The level 2 lockdown restrictions will start on Monday, forcing non-essential establishments to close by 8 p.m. and the curfew will start from midnight until 4 a.m. This comes as just over 1% of the population has been vaccinated so far and the campaign to inoculate elderly people started just last week. COVID-19 has so far claimed more than 56,000 lives out of over 1.6 million confirmed cases. The daily tally of coronavirus infections in India has hit a record low in the past 1.5 months. The country reported over 165,000 cases in the past 24 hours. The total caseload now stands at 27.9 million. Meanwhile, there were more than 3,400 new deaths from coronavirus, bringing the overall fatalities to nearly 326,000. India is second only to the United States in terms of the number of infections. The spike is attributed to the spread of an aggressive new wave of the virus in the South Asian country in the past weeks. The World Health Organization says the Indian coronavirus variant has now been detected in more than 53 countries in the world. And Iran has reported 198 COVID-19 fatalities in 24 hours as the overall death toll in the country reaches almost 80,000. The Iranian Health Ministry reported more than 9,000 new infections, bringing the total cases to over 2.9 million. Iran's number of infections has risen in the past months during what is termed as the fourth wave of the pandemic. Authorities say the country has now weathered the latest uptick of the fast-spreading disease. Iran has also administered more than 4 million COVID-19 vaccines so far. The vaccine rollout is expected to accelerate during the next months with the introduction of homegrown vaccines. New daily coronavirus cases and deaths have dropped in several European countries. The UK on Sunday registered 6 deaths and 3,200 new cases from the disease. Both figures were down from the day before. Italy registered 44 new virus deaths in the past 24 hours. That's a drop by 39 compared with Saturday. It is the lowest daily fatality number Italy has posted since mid-October. New daily cases also decreased there by more than 400 from over 3,300. Elsewhere in Europe, Russia reported 355 new COVID deaths. It's down from 401 fatalities logged the day earlier. Europe started a mass vaccination program in January to contain the disease. In other news, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has called for an independent probe into deadly clashes in the Colombian city of Calais.
It is essential that all those who are reportedly involved in causing injury or death, including state officials, are subject to prompt, effective, independent, impartial, and transparent investigations, and that those responsible are held accountable.
Bachelet demanded that all forms of violence end through dialogue. On Saturday, the Colombian army tightened its control over Calais following weeks of anti-government protests there. Reports say 14 people have died in the city since Friday alone. The demonstrations in Calais were part of nationwide protests that began in April over a proposed tax increase. The government later withdrew the plan, but the protests grew to cover police violence, poverty, and an ongoing health crisis. The ensuing violence left dozens of people dead in Colombia. Thousands of Ethiopians have taken part in a pro-government rally to denounce the U.S. for imposing restrictions on their country over the Tigray conflict. The demonstrators gathered in central Addis Ababa, chanting anti-American slogans. Last week, the U.S. started restricting visas for Ethiopia's government and military officials. Washington also imposed wide-ranging restrictions on economic and security aid to the African country. Tigray in northern Ethiopia has witnessed fighting between federal government forces and fighters loyal to regional leaders since November. The fighting has killed thousands of people. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced too. with many fleeing to neighboring countries. A number of political elites of Afghanistan have attended an international conference on the repercussions of the U.S. military presence in the country. They called the military presence a disruptive U.S. policy towards the country.
The U.S. has pledged to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan by September 11. The move will put an end to America's longest direct war in the country. The announcement of a troop withdrawal has urged some circles to discuss the consequences of the American military presence in Afghanistan over the past two decades. As they say, the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan has had adverse effects on the country on different political, economic, social, and military fronts.
When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, it said the American troops were there to build the country, establish a modern Afghanistan, bring poppy cultivation to zero, and uproot al-Qaeda and terrorism. But now the U.S. says it does not care about such issues. Of course, it was a lie, and we know about that.
Critics of the U.S. policy in Afghanistan believe Washington's involvement in Afghan issues is not limited to its military presence. They say Washington has also created ethnic tensions among local Afghans. Under such circumstances, political elites in Afghanistan say, as Afghans have fully experienced the cost of foreign interference in their country over the past four decades, they need to first come together and make a united nation and then make a strong policy to deal with foreign players in line with Afghanistan's national interests.
The U.S. military presence in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism has not only led to an increase in militancy, poverty, and drug abuse, but apart from its disruptive consequences, it has also resulted in America's longest war. Now, after several years of struggle and hardships inflicted upon Afghanistan and its people, Afghans are welcoming Washington's decision to withdraw its forces from the country by September 11. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Senate Republicans have blocked the creation of a special commission to study the deadly 6th of January attack on the Capitol, dashing hopes for a bipartisan panel amid a Republican push to put the violent insurrection by Donald Trump's supporters behind them. We're prepared for you an article written by Andrew Goldthorpe, a historian of the United States at Leiden University in the Netherlands and host of the podcast America Explained. The piece is titled U.S. Republicans are trying to rewrite the history of the Capitol attack. Don't let them. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Remember how just a few short months ago supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump staged a violent insurrection, how they stormed the Capitol in an attempt to overturn the results of last November's presidential election, looting and vandalizing the seat of American so-called democracy. The fact that they carried firearms, explosives, and handcuffs some wanting to kill Vice President Mike Pence and others to run the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi over with a car, and how the whole thing was incited by the former President Donald Trump, who told the mob beforehand to fight like hell. If you are willing to admit that you remember these things, you're in a smaller minority than you might think. In recent months, Republicans haven't been content to just block the creation of a congressional committee to uncover new facts about the insurrection. They've also moved to rewrite the history of the facts we already know. Republican legislators and right-wing media have suggested either that nothing of particular note happened on that day, or that if it did, it was the fault of left-wing agitators like Antifa and Black Lives Matter movement. Completely unmoored from reality as they may be, Republican voters seem about split between the two explanations, with 48% saying that the people at the Capitol were mostly peaceful, law-abiding Americans, and 54% saying they were a left-wing mob. Often lies like this are designed to obscure what the party itself does. As Republicans have moved more and more overtly towards rejecting the democratic process, they have to try all the more furiously to cover up their tracks. If the party were forced to admit that the man who they twice put forward to be president, and may yet put forward again, had instigated a violent insurrection, it will be hard for them to continue to function as a democratic political party. Rather than admit what they really are, they prefer to deny what they did. But the attempt by Republicans to rewrite history extends beyond lying about their own behavior. Like pathological liars everywhere, Republicans spin vast conspiratorial stories in which they always emerge as either the hero or the victim. Ridiculous claims that the election was stolen or that coronavirus was a minor event which the media overhyped to harm Donald Trump are intended to recast the story of America's recent history in a way which legitimizes the party's ceaseless war against the media and political opposition. What makes Republican lies so insidious is that they have many purposes beyond being literally believed. As Russell Muirhead and Nancy Rosenblum have argued, they're often conspiracy without the theory. No evidence or explanation in support of them is offered because factual belief is not the point. Instead, they serve to have believers demonstrate their loyalty. To repeat something clearly untrue is a sign of debasement, but also dedication, one that reaffirms one's identity as a loyal member of the movement. The lies also draw a clear line between believers on the inside and those on the outside who react furiously to the blatant falsehoods. This only intensifies the perception among Republicans that they are under relentless siege from hostile forces, making the lies even easier to repeat. The inability to reach a shared understanding of recent history poses a graver danger. While political parties and factions will always disagree over how to interpret the world and its history, the give and take and trust, which are vital to the functioning of the democratic politics, depend on a common baseline understanding of reality. Decades ago, the political theorist Hannah Arendt wrote that factual truth is the ground on which we stand and the sky that stretches above us, by which she meant that it sets the parameters and limits of political struggle. If one side refuses to accept those limits, it is signaling that it is capable of doing almost anything to regain the power necessary to remake the world in the shadow of their lies. Another of Hannah Arendt's observations was that once a common understanding of the world has been lost, it is incredibly difficult to reconstruct. The sheer scale of the apparatus, which works to rewrite history from television and radio to social media posts to online propaganda outlets, creates a snug cocoon of validation which is hard to penetrate, especially when it is shared with others. Psychologists have demonstrated that human beings are hardwired to dismiss information that contradicts their worldview and threatens their social relationships. If everyone else in your circle, at home, at the coffee shop, on social media, is accepting the historical rewrite, the easiest thing to do is go along with it. Failing to do so could mean losing friends, falling out with family, and questioning the fundamentals of your own identity. All of these forces create powerful incentives which will remain in place for as long as the party remains committed to its assault on American Congress. It has been said that truth is the first casualty of war, but it is also the first victim of would-be autocrats and dictators. Today's Republican Party has plenty of both. For as long as it and its supporters continue to travel down their current path, they will remain dependent on the constant rewriting of history. There is no other way for them to keep going. As for where exactly they're going, that's a question which ought to worry Americans all. Senate Republicans have blocked the creation of a special commission to study the deadly 6th of January attack on the Capitol, dashing hopes for a bipartisan panel amid a Republican push to put the violent insurrection by Donald Trump's supporters behind them. Republicans killed the effort to set up a 9/11-style inquiry into the attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob, despite broad popular support for such an investigation and pleas from the family of a Capitol police officer who collapsed and died after the siege and other officers who battled the rioters. In a procedural vote in the Senate on Friday, 28th of May, six Republican senators broke ranks to back the commission, which was more than expected, but four fewer than the 10 needed to overcome a filibuster and for it to advance. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer condemned Republican colleagues for blocking a bipartisan commission. Chuck Schumer said in a Senate floor speech immediately after the vote, "Shame on the Republican Party for trying to sweep the horror of that day under the rug because they're afraid of Donald Trump." Meanwhile, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi argued that the vote on the commission bill brought shame to the Senate and would make the country less safe. She indicated the House committees, which are under Democratic leadership, would continue to investigate the attack. Nancy Pelosi said, "Democrats will proceed to find the truth." The insurrection was the worst attack on the Capitol in 200 years and interrupted the certification of Joe Biden's win over Donald Trump. But the Republican Party remains firmly in the grip of Donald Trump, who had made his opposition to the commission very clear. Observers believe that the senior party figures do not want to anger the former president or his legions of supporters and may also fear what the commission might uncover in terms of links between some of the rioters and Republican lawmakers. Though the commission bill passed by the House earlier this month with the support of almost three dozen Republicans, Republican senators said they believed the commission would eventually be used against them politically. Donald Trump has called it a Democrat trap. While initially saying he was open to the idea of the commission, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell turned firmly against the idea in recent days. He has said he believes the panel's investigation would be partisan, despite the even split among party members. Mitch McConnell, who once said Donald Trump was responsible for provoking the mob attack on the Capitol, said of Democrats, "They'd like to continue to litigate the former president into the future." The Republican opposition to the bipartisan panel has revived Democratic pressure to do away with the filibuster, a time-honored Senate tradition that requires a vote by 60 of the 100 senators to cut off debate and advance a bill. With the Senate evenly split 50-50, Democrats needed the support of 10 Republicans to move to the commission bill because Republicans invoked the filibuster. The episode has sparked fresh debate over whether the time has come to change the rules and lower the threshold to 51 votes to take up legislation. On Friday, the Democrats only got 54 votes by the time the vote was gaveled out. Friday's vote marked Senate Republicans' first official use of the filibuster to defeat a bill, and Chuck Schumer said he hopes this was not the beginning of a trend of Republicans blocking reasonable common-sense legislation. The six Republicans who voted for the commission to proceed were Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Susan Collins of Maine, Mitt Romney of Utah, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and Rob Portman of Ohio.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and how about beginning the day by pondering upon an excellent piece of advice from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Do not sit to a table on which there is wine, because no one can guess the very hour in which his soul is grasped.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mo'jiza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, also shaped all our tomorrows. This program is about the life and times, the biographical account of Imam Khomeini. May God bless him and may his soul rest in peace. The leader, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution here in Iran. And, of course, we are going through the second phase of the life and times of Imam Khomeini, and this is in regard to his exile back in 1963. And with me in the studio to discuss that very phase is Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is from the Holy Seminaries of Qum, a very renowned scholar. Salam, hello, and welcome, Sayyidina. And thank you very much for giving us your valuable time today.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great. Sayyidina, we were at that point discussing about some of the great characteristics and virtues of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his and rest his soul. We were talking about the fact that he was very determined to deal with the situation here in Iran, because certainly in terms of the oppression from the Pahlavi regime. And we're now talking about, of course, Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza's father, who was installed since the 1920s, as you mentioned before. And, of course, he was trying to promote an agenda which was very similar to that of Ataturk we discussed in Turkey, where he was trying to secularize Iran and remove religion from the people. But he was doing it in such a way that there was a considerable oppression of the clergy in particular. So we moved to the 60s, and we were mentioning about the fact that since the time of Mossadegh, since in 1953, where Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani's movement in terms of nationalizing the oil industry, about trying to make it a republic or an Islamic republic, but the movement didn't last. It was the coup d'etat done by the CIA, by the Americans, established the son of Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza Pahlavi, as the ultimate and king of kings, we can say, of the region, not only of Iran, but of the entire Middle East. And, of course, they had, through him, strengthened their relations with the Zionist regime. Because we know that round about this time, of course, you know, the Arabs were having their Yom Kippur War, as they called it, with Egypt. And, of course, Iran was helping the Zionist regime at that time through the Raza Shah Pahlavi. And, of course, Imam Khomeini spoke out about that. I mean, he certainly was, you know, these were the things that he was highlighting to the public, that, you know, here we are supporting the very enemy of Islam in the heartland of the region. So we're now on to the second phase where, you know, the Shah has, you know, after that very powerful speech that he gave in the Fezia, the Hawza here in Qum, and, you know, the soldiers went in, and, you know, we know of the atrocities that were then committed in the Hawza Fezia, where, you know, clergy were literally thrown off the rooftops and were martyred. And, you know, the whole Hawza Fezia was ransacked by the soldiers. And, of course, as you see, within a couple of days, Imam Khomeini was sent out of Iran. So I'd like you to speak now a bit about the exile, about this very important phase of Imam Khomeini's life, especially the 14 years in Najaf, where he was participating in the Grand Hawza there, giving lectures and seminars on his own right, because we now discuss the fact that he was also a Marja-i Taqlid as well. So could you enlighten us further as to what that phase of his life was about and how important it was in shaping future events?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In fact, the events of Fezia, which were pertaining to Imam's initial removal from Qum, because he didn't right from the outset be removed from Qom and Iran. He was in fact taken out of Qom,
right,
and passed from pillar to post to different prisons and things,
right,
in Iran.
Okay, so there was the prison period.
Indeed,
as well,
a
right,
period of
right,
prison imprisonment and people's revolts and
sure,
people's want for him to be released and so on.
Yes,
I mean, after 19 days after the events of Ashura, which was on the 6th of June, which is known as the regular Khodad demonstrations and things which take place
right,
on the 14th of Khodad,
right,
a regular event which is renowned here as of that particular event on the 3rd of June 1963.
Right.
He was taken away after that event,
right,
and imprisoned. I mean, 19 days afterwards, he was imprisoned in Khalsa prison.
Right.
And thereupon, he was moved to different places.
And this prison was in Tehran, was it?
It is in Tehran.
It's
and
in
then
Tehran.
He was taken to a military base where he was kept
right,
for a while.
Right.
So this whole process of him being back in Qom and away type of thing,
right,
it took a whole of almost 5 months.
Right.
It was from the 3rd of June till the 4th of November, 64. In fact, 1 year and 5 months.
Right.
A whole 1 year had taken place over
right,
that
right,
process of time. And you see Imam Khomeini, and there are a lot of riots and demonstrations taking place for his release. And at the final straw was August of 1964, when Shah was continuing to make pro-American gestures.
Of course,
pro-American gestures.
Yep.
And particularly in autumn of 1964, when they passed the law that an American person could even kill an Iranian, but he would not be judged here in Iran, he would have to go to America.
Sure.
That Imam Khomeini made his final bash for the Shah of that time. You know,
yeah. And this also comes with the backdrop that, of course, the Pahlavi regime in 1961, under the auspices of John F. Kennedy at the time,
yeah,
under that administration, he was bringing in the so-called White Revolution.
Indeed, that White Revolution, in fact, they again used it against the ulema.
Yes, it was
clergy. The clergies were against the White Revolution. The White Revolution was trying to give the ordinary man an opportunity, whilst the ulema were working with big people and gangsters, so to say, of the time, and they were kind of trying to tune public against them.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing which Imam Khomeini did have a strong word for was this thing about the Americans who could commit crimes in Iran against the Iranian people,
mm-hmm,
and have impunity in reality.
Yeah, it was complete immunity.
Immunity and release from any. To the fact that Imam Khomeini said that a cook of the American embassy could come and kick the Shah in the teeth, and the Shah could not do anything
about it.
Yeah. You know, so as to say, you know, the most petite personnel of the American embassy could do whatever
complete
they could with the absolute authority of Iran.
Sure,
so you
sure,
can see Imam Khomeini was really out for it on this particular issue.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Majlis was really keen to have it going. The Parliament
of
Iran, which was obviously fully dominated by pro-American, pro-Western stooges of the Shah,
sure,
and of course their own personal kickbacks that they as politicians were getting,
sure,
were out to make this law permanent.
Yes, I mean the Majlis's function at that time was simply to ratify whatever the Shah had to
indeed,
say.
Indeed. Yeah. So, whilst in autumn of 64 this was going on and Imam
sure,
Khomeini was making his stand against it, this was the last tour for the Shah.
Right.
He gets him arrested in 1964,
right,
4th of November.
Right.
And the following, or on that same day, or the morning of that day, whatever it may be, he was taken to the airport and sent off to Turkey.
Turkey, yes.
And there he was looked after in Turkey by a Turkish general. And of course, why Turkey was selected was because of the fact that Shah hoped that because Turkey had no ulema ruled there,
that's
in the
right,
sense ulema could not walk around with their turban or religious symbols or anything, that his whole concept would subdue there, and cease to exist.
Well, there's a black and white photograph of Imam Khomeini wandering around in Istanbul, and he's just wearing an overcoat, and there's no religious regalia
indeed.
Of any kind.
Indeed. Yeah. And that's what his aspiration was, that in this process of time, in his exile in Turkey...
Yeah, this will pacify him somehow.
He'll die out, in the sense the whole concept of Imam Khomeini's stand against
Saddam. But then circumstances changed, didn't they?
Indeed, circumstances changed because Imam Khomeini wanted to be back into his... lecturing capacity, wanted to be back with the ulema of the time, wanted to be in the schools and be teaching.
Back into Hoza again,
indeed,
of course.
Teaching whoever he felt were able to be his future idealists.
Right,
the
so
future.
How did he manage to get back to
Najaf?
Well,
what happened in that, that on the 5th of September 65? I mean, he didn't stay in Turkey
for long, hardly
a year.
Right.
He leaves Turkey and goes off for Najaf.
Where
he spends the next 13 years of his time.
That's right.
So this 14 years exile is a year, just under a year in Turkey, and then the rest of the 13 years
is
in
Iraq.
Right. And of course, not as such in Iraq, in the sense he's then forced out by Iraq in the latter part of the 70s, where he's in Kuwait and then goes off to France.
Sure.
But that's a whole story in itself.
Itself, yes, of course.
The last year is that very important phase of his pre-revolution phase.
It's interesting that he's coming into Najaf at the backdrop of one of the most cruel coups in Iraq at that time, which was the coming of the Ba'athist regime in 1958. And, you know, he's coming at a backdrop of this murderous regime that comes in. How does he manage to survive that exile there?
This is Islamic history.
Yeah.
You see, you had Imam Muhammad Baqir al-Islam and Imam Jafar Sadiq al-Islam being the best promoters of the fiqh of the Shiite opinion during the time when the Bani Abbasis and the Bani Umayyah are fighting for it. You know, so that fight of the enemy gives the opportunity for the best to come out.
That's right.
You know, they're fighting amongst themselves. What happened when Imam Khomeini settled himself in Najaf? He started teaching in Sheikh Ansari's madrasa. Sheikh Murtaza Ansari, who's a very prominent. In fact, Sheikh Ansari changed the whole principles of fiqh. And laid down very important principles of jurisprudence in his own time.
Right.
And that madrasa was obviously quite a prominent madrasa within the Shia community's theological teachings.
I mean, this is the elite we are talking about here in Najaf. Yes.
So he settles in there and starts delivering lectures of various types, both jurisprudential lectures, as well as the fact that very principle that he wants to set up a future identity of Islamic movement,
a future identity of Islamic society. Yeah.
You see, what was very important in these this period of time is not only is Imam Khomeini promoting the whole concept of Shia teaching, but he's also interpreting it to be a practical performance, a practically performed theory for the people.
Yes,
you know, it's not just an ordinary theory of the books.
It was a practical outline of exactly how
he was trying
to do work.
Indeed.
Yeah.
He was trying to put to work all those Islamic theories into a practical application for the people.
Exactly.
So what he was really trying to do was he was trying to put the theories into a definition of what we as a layman would say political application of religion.
Right.
And that was very important, what Imam Khomeini, because from the outset, Imam Khomeini had been in the political arena of what was happening, even though the enemies, his enemies have always endeavored to say, why don't you stay in the mosque? Why don't you stay in the madrasas? Why don't you just do the teaching? He had always been out front line. Taking on political issues which were affecting the community.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you see what the enemies of the Islamic movement have always tried to do is to separate politics from religion. Imam Khomeini dragged it in, screaming and shouting, so as to say, the word politics into religion, even though the enemies attempted to pull it out.
As you quite rightly say, Imam Khomeini was unique in that sense that he comes out as a firebrand with... simply pointing out the fact it's not Islam. You know, if we're not talking about politics, we're not talking about Islam at all.
No, I mean, one of the main things that the principles of Imam Khomeini's concepts was this, that the laws of society should be made according to Shariat law.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
In on the basis of how God defines the application of people's lives.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really then ordinary, it doesn't mean just the fact that the lead, the authority should be a religious authority.
Mm.
It means that religious authority should be in everyday life of the people.
Exactly.
That's what he was trying to conjure up in people's understanding.
That's right.
Hey, you don't need an authority with a stick.
No.
You need a stick to be the part of the whole system.
System.
Where so much so that people realize that they have a responsibility to each other, not only as personal interaction, but as a religious interaction.
Yeah.
In other words, for example, I could say as an ethical discussion, we could say is that, for example, a father, when he goes out working for the livelihood of his children, he shouldn't feel that he's doing a favor for his children, but he has a responsibility from the Almighty to do that for the kids.
That's right. That's
so
right.
That attitude Imam Khomeini wants to bring home, that everything that a society does, it should do with the aspiration that it is to fulfill God's obedience. And God's instructions.
Exactly.
And that is what Imam Khomeini is nurturing in these discussions. Of course, he goes to a very high level where he's defining the role of a walayat al-faqih, in other words, the authority of a jurisprudence in the absence of the 12th Imam.
Yeah.
But in reality, he's trying to nurture a society of religious practices.
Exactly.
But by defining the absolute authority in that system.
Exactly.
And he does it very well. Mm-hmm. And he does it on, you know, this whole concept is developed in front of students, particularly in the 70s.
Yeah. Yep.
Early 70s in Najaf, where he's lecturing in this madrasa, and he's talking about the meaning of Hukumat Islami.
Exactly.
Islamic government.
This is the two big famous works that come out of those houses. The first is the Gnosis, the one that is the Jihad al-Akbar, the one that is to, you know, for that responsibility to be carried out properly by, as you say, a walayat al-faqih, a supreme jurist. He's got to have that training, that discipline to get rid of his nafs-e amara, to be the example, the lead by which you look at him.
In
like
fact,
many hadiths, as they say, by the Holy Prophet, that you just by looking at him, you are reminded of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In fact, you're making a very good link here, brother. The fact that, you know, Imam Khomeini is the only marja taqlid who says that in his line of conditions that a person qualifies for marja taqlid, is that he says one of the attributes of such a person should be that he should not have the desire for the world.
Exactly.
Was there that etiyat wajib, that cautious, compulsory caution, is the only one found in Imam Khomeini's rulings. It's not found in any other Maraja's ruling where it says etiyat wajib, he should not have worldly desires. That is a very interesting. Imam Khomeini is saying, even if you come to the level of a marja taqlid, the shaitan can come home to you.
Exactly.
But you should kick him out.
Kick him out.
And the only way to do that is, as a marja taqlid, you should not have this character in your heart either.
Aye.
You shouldn't think, okay, I'm becoming a marja taqlid. Wow, I'm going to have so many people following me.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay,
but no,
that immediately is that world's desire, which Imam Khomeini reprimands. And this is a very good link you're making between the ethical discussions that Imam Khomeini develops in his 40s.
And then this position of walaya.
And this position of wilayah.
Because
with the discussion of the wilayat al-faqih, I mean, this is a very important issue which Imam Khomeini, through his teachings, raises people like Sheikh Sadr from it.
Yes.
You know, Sheikh Sadr is that last component of his teachings who was shaheed in Iraq.
He says,
kind of drown yourself in Khomeini.
Drown yourself.
In one of his speeches, drown yourself in Imam Khomeini. So, you know, it's that absoluteness that he has in recognizing Imam Khomeini's... and what was his age? He wasn't in his 70s or 80s. He was 48 years old.
Yes.
You know,
and I like that, what you raised there, that drowning also, because there's mystical poems from Imam Khomeini about drowning with the beloved, you know, because he's talking about nothing but Allah. It's not even about himself. He's just wanting to see that the system is in place, as you say, of a society of pious people who are carrying out these edicts according to the Sharia, but the whole goal is to be with the beloved, isn't it?
Indeed. But then you see, being with the beloved doesn't mean that you abrogate all responsibilities for the world.
No, it
this
doesn't.
It's
putting it all in
focus.
But you
see, this is what
focus.
Is important, is to understand. Now, whilst Imam Khomeini was an advocate of mysticism, he was not an advocate of excommunication.
Excommunication, no,
from
we're
the
not
world.
Talking about
you
that.
You see, because
no,
what
no.
Imam Khomeini, in his, no. throughout his poetical presentation of coming close to God, was not that individual himself endeavors to come close to God. He should be a tool by which he could bring the society to God as well.
That's right.
And that's what Imam Khomeini replicated as being that manifestation of being that tool.
It's like putting everything in its right place, isn't it? Putting it all in the right context in terms of
earning your money, going to your job, whatever it happens to be. But it's all, at the end of the day, to be in line with what is required to be a good Muslim.
Indeed. Hmm. So coming back to this, that the world that Imam Khomeini was trying to conjure up in the minds of his students was that they should have this idea of leading the Muslim Ummah towards God by implementing God's rules.
Yes.
So when he's teaching these things in the Hawza, he's quite clearly in the seminaries. Mm. He's quite clearly bringing this home to people. Mm. And other than that, of course, he was also teaching philosophy, and that in itself was a big headache for some ulema.
Right.
Of the time, right. Some academic, some scholars of the time.
Right.
I mean, I remember in one of his statements, he says that when I was teaching philosophy, some of the students used to wash the bowl from which my son used to drink water from. Mm. In the sense that some people felt that teaching philosophy was kofr.
Oh my goodness.
It was an act of an insult to Islam.
My goodness.
Because, of course, they did not themselves
understand the fact
the level by which one is using philosophy in understanding God.
Exactly.
And in understanding philosophy, there is a lot of discussion that if you're not capable of extrapolating those meanings from philosophical arguments, then you rather not go down that line at all.
Mm. And because the aspect that why Imam Khomeini is using philosophy is to put the rationale behind the system he was going to put in place, not only for what was happening in Iran, but for the whole Muslim world. I mean,
it was essential that through this, as you're pointing out, the rest of the world understands the character, the nature by which this movement is moving towards God.
Exactly.
You see, that
creator
must be conceptualized in its entirety, in his entirety.
Yeah.
So much so that we could say that this hukuma, this government, is under his supervision. If that is not realized, then yet again, such a character of a vilayat faqih would be again a dictator.
Exactly. It would be completely misconstrued.
And that's why Imam Khomeini says that where there's an existence of the vilayat faqih, it's a tool of removal of dictatorship.
Well, the thing is, this is the beauty, isn't it, of what he's setting out in his exile and in terms of what he's preaching in Najaf, in the Hawza, although his immediate audience is the students, but he's going well beyond that to the masses and pointing out the fact that the people's participation in the system, they are saying yes to this system, removes the concept of dictatorship.
Yeah, but you see, when you're saying people at that time were interested in knowing what Imam Khomeini was doing outside.
Yeah.
You see, more and more people, more and more of these lectures of Imam Khomeini were becoming cassettes and being smuggled into Iran.
That's right, yes.
They were becoming articles.
They called it the cassette revolution, in a sense,
And they were being smuggled into.
Yep.
In other words, people wanted to remember what Imam Khomeini was standing for. They weren't ignoring the fact that he's now in exile. He's another Majid Taqlid sitting in Najaf or something like that. No, the aspirations to connect with Imam Khomeini's thoughts were still there. And that's why, when, as you pointed out, it became a people's revolt in wanting Imam Khomeini back rather than Imam Khomeini's desire to be back
because
to lead.
They began to understand, you know, the ideology, the rationale by which Imam Khomeini was taking the stand against not only the Pahlavi regime, but he also pointed out, even while he was in Najaf, that even the criminals that were there in power there, he said, your turn will be next. Things like this, you know, there were comments that, you know, this was something that was really going to revolutionize the entire Muslim world.
In fact, what Imam Khomeini said in a lecture to the Islamic Awakening people, after the revolution,
very interesting.
We expected
Egyptians
to revolt immediately.
Mm.
Because Imam Khomeini had sent a message of an ideological change.
Yeah.
A wave of ideological changes that were anticipated.
Yes.
But of course, we see it immediately after the revolution in Imam Khomeini, you had puppets like Anwar Sadat, who became an obstacle in these movements from coming to life.
Yep.
You had Mubarak after him, then you had Bin Ali in Tunisia. They all became obstacles once Imam Khomeini's movement came to its full essence.
Yeah, and this was only because, of course, Imam Khomeini, in a sense, by what he had done and the fact that he gave such a beautiful paradigm about how this system was going to function in Iran. Because this is the thing, this was what the unique thing that no other ulema and no other marja'i had done so far, was actually to come up with a model.
Actually,
he was actually coming up with a model of how this system was actually going to function.
You see, Imam Khomeini was not really and truly creating something of his own.
No.
But Imam Khomeini, this whole concept...
He was putting the flesh onto
indeed,
it, wasn't he?
Not only just putting the flesh onto it, he was making people realize that this is not something out of the blue.
Yeah.
That it had always been within the theories of religious application
from the
of
school
society.
Of Ahlul Bayt, yes.
In the school of Ahlul Bayt, because of the fact that in the school of Ahlul Bayt, it did not neglect the fact that ulema would be a component in continuing the message of the Ahlul Bayt to the people.
There's a beautiful thing that you remind me of from Allama Mutahhari, Shaheed Mutahhari. One of the students of Imam Khomeini, of course, he was martyred in the earlier years of the revolution by the Munafiqeen. And he points out beautifully three things that, you know, he was saying that the people needed in this day and age in order to make progress. And he said one of the things was that they need a school of thought that gives a progressive line in terms of understanding the concept of walaya. And through that walaya, the acceptance of that walaya, as it was in the past with the masumin, they have progress. They have prosperity and progress. And this was the thing that was so badly needed, because there was a vacuum in the Muslim world where many schools of thought were